welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we'll be talking about some of what you didn't hear or what's still going on with the controversy over missing girls in D.C. and sort of what that says about other things. We're also going to talk about citizen-to-citizen diplomacy in the Korean Peninsula and recent white supremacist news out of the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. as well. But before we can move on. Despite what you're hearing from just about all U.S. media outlets, including the so-called progressive ones, Venezuela had a very successful vote yesterday. Over 8 million people turned out to vote for delegates to the Constituent Assembly that will rewrite the Constitution and then put it up for approval via a popular referendum. This was the same process followed in 1999 to establish the first quote-unquote Bolivarian Constitution that has governed the country so far during the presidencies of Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro. And context is important here. There are widespread reports of mass abstention marring the vote. However, when looked at contextually, this is definitely not the way to look at it. It's worth noting that for almost the entire period that Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro were in power, the opposition claimed the 1999 Constitution was just a sham, a power grab. Then, when unable to unseat Nicolas Maduro in a presidential election, the opposition changed its tune. It used the Constitution to launch a recall, which failed, then participated in the National Assembly election, where they actually succeeded. Recently, the opposition has been howling that yesterday's vote had not been done according to the correct constitutional procedure in terms of calling it. So in other words, the opposition has been saying the 1999 Constitution is valid and legitimate and should be respected. So it's worth noting that in 1999, the turnout for the referendum for the Assembly was 37%, while the vote for the Assembly itself was 46%. At a time when there was no economic, political, or social crisis in the country, after Chavez had been peacefully elected as the president on a platform of calling the Assembly and writing a new constitution. Yesterday's vote, in which 8 million people voted, was a 41% turnout. So how exactly is that illegitimate? In fact, it's somewhat remarkable given the fact the opposition tried to disrupt the vote by blocking roads and polling places. Over 200 polling places were physically attacked by the opposition. And that in the lead up to the vote, the whole thing was shot through with elements demanding U.S.-backed coups, taking videos with assault rifles, the opposition that is, and calling for an uprising. Six people died on the election day, including members of the police and National Guard who were attacked while attempting to guard polling places. What is also notable is this vote comes 1 week after the opposition held a sham referendum of its own. And even by its own inflated standards, the opposition claims of turnout of 1 million, turnout of 7 million is 1 million voters less than what the pro-socialist forces got out yesterday. However, that claim of 7 million is clearly bogus. The Commission of International Observers, who the opposition themselves invited to observe the election, noted that they could not establish with quote-unquote certainty how many people turned out and that there was no real secret balloting. This is just scratching the surface of claims of irregularities throughout the vote. The same commission noted the government did nothing to interfere with that process. So, in 2 weeks, both sides of the conflict held votes. Even in the best case scenario, the pro-socialist, pro-government forces got a million more votes than the opposition, best case scenario for the opposition. They did that in the context of roadblocks, physical assaults on polling places, sanctions from the United States, and a calls for a coup from El País. Honestly, it's really no surprise. While the U.S. media constantly portrays Venezuela that there is a good turnout, that Venezuela is an economic basket case, the truth is very different. Wired magazine, for instance, noted about Venezuela's recent electrical crisis, currently the following, quote, Venezuela's economic success fueled its electricity crisis, end quote. And indeed, from 1999 to 2015, GDP increased in Venezuela by 43%, the agricultural GDP 27%. In 2015, when shortages in basic goods were at their highest, GDP was still actually higher than in 2004. Unemployment sunk 62.5%. between 1999 and 2015, when it hit its lowest level ever of 6%. In just the years 2003 to 2007, extreme poverty was reduced 70%. The Venezuelan government has also extended health care to the entire population and it was enshrined as a right in the 1999 Constitution. It has extensively built up a vastly expanded educational system, and the government is also pursuing a massive project to make housing a right as well, and that since 2011 has already built 1.7 million low-cost homes. homes. In the 2017 budget, over 73% of annual budget will go towards the state's social programs, 73% now, and specifically to areas such as housing, health, education, and public works, as well as to the citizens' neighborhood organizations known as communal councils. It's also worth noting here one factor about these programs. Many people claim that they're just populist and only exist because of oil wealth used to purchase loyalty. However, way under the radar, President Maduro has taken steps to lessen the dependence on oil money and has instituted a progressive taxation system that now finances 83% of government expenditures. So no wonder the opposition, which is primarily confined to the mainly more upscale parts of the population, is so up in arms. The socialist government is helping the poor and working class at the expense of the wealthy elites. The opposition are the people who want to roll back all those great things I just mentioned and return the country back to the hands of the aforementioned wealthy elite. And a clue to who the opposition really is can come from the fact that they've been burning people alive in the streets who were just suspected of being chavistas, just suspected now, and in some cases explicitly targeting black people and using racial slurs in the attacks. The election yesterday was a sign that society in Venezuela has polarized. The nation is in a cul-de-sac on how to move forward with the progressive socialist future initiated by President Chavez. Obviously, the bulk of people who decided to participate in the two recent processes want to continue that process and recognize that that requires a new document, a new constitution to govern deeper changes to the country. For instance, while all you hear about in U.S. elections are elections like this, Venezuela has also embarked on a massive attempt at grassroots democracy. As one analyst related, Venezuela has established a massive network of communal councils and communes at the local and regional level. The communal councils are grassroots bodies based on local neighborhoods involving a few hundred families. With popular assemblies as their highest decision-making body, the councils take responsibility for key local programs and developments. Communes, made up of elected representatives from the councils, work on larger-scale projects over a greater area. Venezuela's Ministry of Communes says there are 46,566 registered communal councils in the country and 1,620 communes. So what's really at stake in Venezuela is grassroots democracy aimed at renewing itself to push forward a new type of society centered on people over profits against the same old pro-U.S. austerity type of government that will drive up inequality and racism. We've noted here that many of Trump's executive orders often require congressional action in order to really be impactful. As you might expect of a Congress controlled by climate deniers, they are moving forward apace to do just that. For instance, there's a bill the House passed on July 19th, the, quote, Promoting Cross-Border Energy Infrastructure Act, which would prevent presidents from blocking pipelines that cross the U.S. border. Another bill awaiting approval and introduced by Liz Cheney would also block the president from declaring a moratorium on federal coal leases, something presidents have been able to do since 1920. There's also the, quote, Transparency and Honesty in Energy Regulations Act, which would block the Obama-era requirement that regulations examine the social cost of carbon emissions. A spokesperson from the League of Conservation Voters described this as like saying, quote, Let's look at the health impact of cigarette smoking, but don't count cancer, end quote. Additionally, there is the Ozone Standards Implementation Act that the House passed on July 18th, a bill designed to assist EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt in delaying the implementation of the Obama administration standards regulating smog emissions for a year. The House is also trying to use the spending bill designed to keep the government going to prevent the use of federal funds to enforce energy-efficient light bulb standards, despite the fact it would save consumers almost $200 billion a year and reduce carbon emissions by 700 million tons, the equivalent of 204 coal power plants. So while some people are decrying a bogged down Trump agenda on the climate and on immigration, two of Trump's biggest priorities, they are making quite a bit of very negative progress. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we continue our conversation with April Goggins, who's an organizer here in Washington, D.C. with Keep D.C. for Me and Black Lives Matter D.C. April, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thanks for having me, Eugene.
So I wanted to start with what is a relatively significant controversy that has been emerging here since last week in Washington, D.C., and that ties in very heavily to a lot of what we talk on this show, and that's sort of, you know, who the police really are and the role of white supremacists. There is an officer who was wearing a shirt that certainly was inappropriate. For our listeners here, give them a sense of what's happening. What is this controversy over this officer? What was on the T-shirt? And so on, if you would.
Absolutely. So here, I actually live in the 7th District. So this officer had a shirt actually on over his uniform. And this shirt says, on the top, on the back, it says power shift. The letter O is replaced by the sun cross. And a lot of folks are, you know, may or may not be familiar with the sun cross. The sun cross you can generally see on the Klan's their uniforms or whatever they are. It's been, you know, a very popular white supremacist symbol for some time. Underneath that, you know, they clearly state that it's MPDC, which is the Metropolitan Police Department for the District of Columbia, and it says 7th District on the bottom. In the middle of that T-shirt, it says, "Let me see your waistband, Joe." That is a very popular, it was the term that police officers throughout the history of D.C., especially in black neighborhoods, used to justify jump outs, basically to say, "Let me see your waistband," whether there is anything in there or not, whether they could see it or not, would justify why they could stop people, brutalize people by literally jumping out of their cars and violating their rights in unconstitutional ways. You know, I did a little reading on power shift and know that it was a unit, there's power shifts throughout the department, but a shift that they work. But former Chief Diane Grooms used to oversee that unit, and the unit was kind of created to kind of quote unquote deal with the violent elements in the community. So you got this like mix of like white supremacy, toxic masculinity, just running wild to the point that an officer feels like they have the, you know, the right and just the audacity to wear this, not only just on the job, but to the courthouse. So it begs the question, to what extent does this represent the overall culture of MPD? And then on top of that, you know, the fact that these are the officers in black communities, if nothing else, gives credence to what we've been basically screaming about for, you know, you and me, our work, at least the last 3 or so years. That is, you know, this is not just us making up things about how and who is policing our neighborhoods, but now folks are perhaps starting to see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, certainly what the Metropolitan Police in Washington always say is when anyone raises any question is, well, you know, we're not saying we're perfect, but we're not like one of these Baltimore, Ferguson, you know, racist police departments, blah, blah, blah. But this seems like this is indicative of that's not the case. And this also, the 7th District is also a district in the MPD that has had other issues, if I'm not mistaken, one with childhood sex rape, other things like that. I mean, talk a little bit about the reputation of this police district.
Right. This police district is known for, on the streets here, picking up folks, especially young black men, young women, between different crews and kind of starting whisper campaigns, basically, where they tell folks on the street so-and-so snitched about something, which actually didn't happen, which increases the violence over here. I mean, those things are well known. NSAID, I think is what they're called, or NSID, what used to be the jump out squads, is notorious for just absolutely breaking laws when it comes to quote unquote searching people's cars. And you know, this is coming from, you have generations out here in the 7th District who will tell you about some of these officers who are now at the top, about just the corruption, the taking of money. And like you mentioned, there was the child sex ring. You had an officer who, I believe, murdered his girlfriend. I mean, you've got officers who, if you look, there's a tremendous amount of cases about just sexual harassment of queer folks in 7th District. You know, if you look at, you know, there's been 6 shootings in D.C. And if you look at how many of those were the 7th District, you start to see a picture of even just this year. You can look up things like Raphael Briscoe's murder, where they basically did a drive-by on the young black man running away and then basically planted a gun, from what I could see. I mean, 7th District, you know, they have been in addition to just that, their level of surveillance and harassment of me and other Black Lives Matter activists is just out of control. And it's something that everybody knows, but nobody's talking about in the city council. Mayor Bowser will do anything she can to try to get more police on the ground. So what you have is just a notoriously bad, not that I would necessarily say that there's a good alternative, but just a really terrible district. That what we've been saying in our work is that all of MPD needs like an overhaul of like third party like investigations, DOJ, all of those things, which we know is not going to change the institution of policing. But absolutely, people need to be aware of what is happening. And at the top of that list, and I'll just end by saying, is Peter Newsom. Mm. And that Peter Newsom has been at the top of, Police Chief Peter Newsom has been at the top of police conduct for decades. Whether he was IAB, he was the one in charge of looking at the DOJ memorandum of agreement. So he knows this behavior back and forth. And he has continuously shown that if you are in, if you are in a good place with him, or if the alternative is him looking bad, he's going to back you up and he is not going to stop whatever it is that you do, especially to Black folks in D.C.
Mm-hmm. And is it fair to say here, is it fair to make a connection between everything you just outlined in terms of MPD's record of racism, of brutality, of different things coming out of the 7th District and elsewhere in the city? Is it fair to connect that as well with the repression of protesters that we saw at the inauguration this year?
Absolutely. I mean, this is Peter Newsom's almost obsession with how much of a large-scale attack on those who would speak out, or the most marginalized. It's almost like he just, all of these things, he is just, reproducing this repressive culture that has a lot to do with it, also with NPD's relationships with the IDF and all kind of other foes, so that when you see, folks even just being around protests, because they detest protesters and protest so much, they will kettle 200 people and try to put them in jail. It all ties in. What people, and I'll be honest, that people are feel much safer looking and outraged at the inauguration stuff because they presume that most of those folks are white. Mm. So when you hear this same kind of stuff goes on in 7th District, 6th District, you tend to feel like, oh, well, they must have done something. It's a violent place. So the police have to act more violent. And I would argue that whether that was going on or not, police are there to protect property. And that's why they went after the folks during the inauguration. And that's exactly why they go after Black folks, because gentrification is a big thing. They've got to protect those buildings, those people who are bringing the buildings.
And, D.C., which has the unique status of not being a state, a lot of the law enforcement is very tied to federal officials. I mean, do you think that Donald Trump's recent statements basically endorsing police brutality are sort of also in some way connected to this, where, perhaps there's just a continuum of increasing the repressive forces of the state?
Absolutely. What you're seeing now is just a hyper state of repression. This is like the mental militarizing of the police, that now you are giving them carte blanche to do whatever they see necessary to control people. And so with Trump saying exactly, I mean, he literally said, break all of the laws that you need to maintain order. Mm. And do it in such a way that, that I'm going to tell you that it's okay to do it the way that you all have been in the news doing it. That's clearly wrong, clearly violent, clearly racist, and definitely anti-Black. But I don't know that people are awake enough. And I hate sometimes using that awake, but really, I don't think people's senses are heightened enough to understand the depth of what is coming out of Sessions all the way down to what is coming from Trump to Peter Newsom, is that we're living in an age where it is becoming like absolutely okay, legal, morally, whatever, to repress folks, to be violent with folks.
Mm-hmm.
And so Trump deciding to tell people, you know, how they need to handle folks and all of that should be shocking to people. I think we make jokes just about, hey, you know, he's wild, he's crazy, he does whatever. But the fact of the matter is that now folks have a duty of all duties to not only fight now and continue to resist now, but to go back and get some historical basis about what this looks like. What are you looking at? What are you hearing? It's part of a much larger, deeper, more serious. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately, but I appreciate it. That's April Goggins, who you were just hearing from Black Lives Matter DC, and also Keep DC for Me if you want to check out more of their work. We're going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, DC. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about continued tensions in Northeast Asia, but some people-to-people efforts to lower those tensions as well. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Medea Benjamin, who's the co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, thank you so much for being with us again.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Eugene.
No, of course, of course. So you were just recently in South Korea, I believe, at a conference, I think it was, related to the THAAD issue. For our listeners, just what was going on over there? What were you participating in and so on, if you could?
Well, it wasn't so much a conference. It was a trip to the village where the THAAD is being deployed. That's in Sangju. It's about 135 miles southeast of Seoul. And we got an opportunity to spend some time with the villagers, to speak at a large rally that they were doing, and to witness the tremendous efforts that they've been making for almost a year now to stop the deployment of this weapons system, which includes a nightly candlelight vigil in two villages. Well, one is more of a bigger city, but it is amazing that they've been doing it every single night with spirit and energy and resolve. So it was a great opportunity. And we also then had a chance to speak with lots and lots of different people in Seoul that represent different organizations, political parties. We went to the National Assembly, spoke to the assemblyman who heads the committee on issues around the threats to security. So it was a quite an extensive 5 days.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, and I'm curious about what the mood is in South Korea. I mean, we hear so much about sort of like the overhanging crisis situation. I hear very few sort of personal on the street kind of what are people in South Korea feeling. What was your takeaway about the mood there in what I think is clearly a tense situation?
It's interesting because you hear a lot of people talk about the danger in the region, but they don't feel like North Korea is going to attack the South. There is a sense that it would all be too devastating to really happen. And the people that we met with were more concerned about the U.S. stirring up provocations that would bring this to more of a real possibility than exists right now. They feel that the U.S. has never promoted peace after the armistice that was signed in 1953, that the war games that have been going on and increased in intensity have really been provocative towards the North, that this 83 military bases that are dotting the entire nation of South Korea are also a provocation. The 28,500 soldiers, U.S. soldiers that are in South Korea, that it makes the regime of North Korea feel encircled, and that this is part of the danger, that there have been attempts over the years to have dialogue, and those attempts have been thwarted sometimes by the South Korean government, as in the last government, but almost always by the United States, except during the Clinton years. And so there's a real desperation to change the dynamic forces to ones that would be promoting de-escalation of tensions.
And I'm somewhat curious here, too, is what how President Moon has been reacting here, the South Korean president. I mean, he came in critical of THAAD. I know that he had at one point sort of blocked some of the additional launchers coming in. People thought perhaps they could reverse the process of THAAD coming in. Where is the South Korean government standing on that currently?
Well, there was a lot of hope when we were there that the call for an environmental assessment would delay the whole process for about a year, that would give the opponents of THAAD, including the local residents, more time to pressure the president and continue the movement towards not deploying THAAD. Unfortunately, as soon as we left with the most recent missile test by the North Koreans, President Moon reversed that decision and said that he was going to go ahead with the adding of four more launchers, which would complete the system there. And this has sparked a new round of protests in South Korea, people vowing to block the roads, to stop the equipment from getting in, and criticizing the president for his response.
And, you know, along those lines, and I think this is sort of certainly very relevant in terms of what we've been seeing sort of from the president here, I should say, is this sort of the rhetoric. And I mean, it almost is like sort of Trump's whole thing is, well, the easiest way to solve this is just to put as many threats in, to be as aggressive as possible. But it almost seems like that's kind of the reverse from what you've said so far of what seems to actually make sense in the context of the broader situation.
Well, I was in North Korea 2 years ago, and while I certainly found that that regime was extremely repressive and one that is extremely paranoid. On the other hand, you have to understand the basis for that paranoia. We talked about the 83 military bases, the continuing war games that are happening, the way that the North Korean government feels encircled. But they also have a logic that they look at the other countries around the world that have given up on their nuclear weapons systems, and that was Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, and they see what happened to them. And they say that the only way for us to ensure that we are not invaded by the United States is to have our own nuclear deterrent. So there is a lot of logic in that, and it's important to recognize that as long as the United States keeps this threat, and one threat that I didn't mention is that it has always assumed that it has the right to a first strike against North Korea, meaning a nuclear strike, and it has put South Korea under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. So as long as the North Korean regime feels that the U.S. is going to attack it, they will continue to pursue nuclear weapons as their only way to stop such an invasion.
It's one of those things that also just seems a little, I don't even know what the right word for it, frustrating or whatever it may be, given that there are actually peace proposals on the table, certainly one from the Chinese that I think sort of starts with the freeze of these massive U.S. military war games, which seems like a relatively easy thing for America to give up to reduce nuclear tensions on the Korean Peninsula, but it just doesn't seem like that's there. But there are avenues, I guess, is the point I'm making here. It's not as if this is just some unknowable Sphinx-like situation.
Well, that's right. And unlike the Middle East that has become so complex right now and so difficult to unravel, this is less so. And there are this idea of a freeze for a freeze, freezing the war exercises in response for a freeze on the North Koreans' testing of both nuclear weapons and missiles, is something that was recently put forward by the Chinese, but has actually been put forward by the North Korean government itself several different times. And the U.S. has constantly rejected this. So I think we need to put pressure on our own government to go forward with this freeze for freeze. And you know, Eugene, as happens in so many different scenarios, when those of us who want to see peaceful resolutions to conflicts around the world put out logical things like our government should go for negotiations because coercion, including constantly ratcheting up sanctions, doesn't work, we are treated as the ones that are so naive and that this is simply impossible to have negotiations with the regime that is so crazy as the North Koreans. But it really is the only logical way forward, since it's absolutely clear that coercion just makes the North Korean regime feel more and more encircled and determined to speed up the process of testing. And in fact, we've seen since Trump has been in office that they have sped up the process.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's the case. And it's a very good point. I mean, it seems it's somewhat almost like sort of reality is suspended in a lot of these discussions where it's like, well, we could never talk with X person or Y regime. But, you know, like Saudi Arabia is our closest ally, or one of them, Israel, probably the closest governmental ally of the United States. Also, obviously, with human – I mean, it's not as if, quote unquote, human rights abuses or, you know, different economic systems or whatever it may be are any real barrier to the United States when they want or feel that they're getting comparative advantage from working from someone. It's just when it's the opposite way. But it's not as if there's some sort of, you know, moral barrier or something like that between the United States having – I mean, it seems to me that the most logical thing would just be to go to North Korea and have relations with them. I mean, if we're going to have relations with, you know, whoever, all these other people, it just doesn't make any sense to me, really.
Well, yes, and you would think that the U.S. would learn from the regime change that we've been involved in recent years. And when the Trump administration says that the Chinese are not doing enough to pressure North Korea, the Chinese are worried about regime change, because what would happen if the North Korean government were overthrown? They have no idea. They think it would be chaos. It would be a mass exodus of refugees flowing over to both South Korea and trying to get into China. And they want to stop that. So they don't want to see a regime change happen. They want to see a slow transition. And you would think that the United States would recognize that as well and would welcome attempts to diffuse the tension, would welcome trade as a way of opening up the North Korean government. And indeed, there has been a trade zone that was set up along the north and south, the Kaesong industrial zone, that has been closed down in recent years, but President Moon would like to reopen it. The North Koreans would like to reopen it. And that would be certainly a way to engage the North Korean government and part of the move towards negotiations.
You know, I think that's a very good point. And you know, one thing that it just this is just came to me as you were talking, but I think about this every day, but certainly it frustrates me every day, is, you know, it almost seems like there's no institutional memory in the U.S. media establishment either. I mean, like, what U.S. regime change operation, especially in the last 15 years, has actually gone well? And no one ever says, when they're writing these articles, these editorials, gotta get tough on North Korea, gotta have sanctions. I mean, you'd think they'd just say, well, like, how did that work out the last time we did this? And obviously the answer would be not very well. But it's almost like this sort of like institutional amnesia in the way a lot of this stuff is reported time in. You know, the country's changed, but it seems like there's no ever, well, what happened in Libya? What happened in Iraq? So on and so forth.
Right. And it's also among our elected officials just a imperial mindset that doesn't allow them, or maybe it's because of the corrupt way our system works and where they get their money from for their election campaigns. But whether it's their institutional mindset or their where their bread is buttered, you can see the vast majority of Democrats and Republicans voting for constantly putting the squeeze on North Korea, constantly increasing the sanctions, and they must know that the sanctions hurt the North Korean people and strengthen their dependence on the government. And yet they move in that sheep-like manner of constantly imposing greater and greater hardships on the people, thinking that somehow what they're going to rise up against their regime and then there will be democracy installed. As you said, it hasn't worked out like that.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think it's an important point to continue to be made here, too, that, you know, sanctions, which I think are often portrayed as sort of the benevolent alternative, really are a weapon of war, you know, in and of themselves.
Oh, totally. We certainly saw that in the case of Iraq. And unfortunately, I think people don't get to see it in the case of North Korea, partly because the North Korean government itself is so secretive. I mentioned that I was there, but it's not like you can sort of walk around unimpeded. And aside from the language barrier, there's also the fact that you're being minded by a government official. But now it's going to be worse because the Trump administration has made it illegal for Americans to go to North Korea. So it's very hard to see for ourselves what the sanctions mean for ordinary North Koreans, but we should understand that it is a country that is quite isolated and that the sanctions only further isolate it.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I'm curious, do you think that's maybe part of why Trump made that move on that travel ban to try to prevent that kind of citizen to citizen type of diplomacy or people to people type of diplomacy that can maybe open up sort of new avenues here in America potentially?
Well, it was the response to the young American Adam Warmbier being arrested and coming back in a coma and unfortunately losing his life. But it was a response that was not well thought out, because if you talk to many of the groups and people who have gone to North Korea over recent years, they have had no problems. And one would think that encouraging more of these people-to-people ties would be a good thing. I just think the Trump administration just reaches out for anything as a response to be seen as being tough and not letting North Korea get away with taking actions that the U.S. dislikes, whether it's the terrible treatment of Adam Warmbier, and that was awful, or whether it is the tests. The U.S. tries to respond with shows of force that just keep ratcheting up the tension. So the response to this latest missile test was to do their own shooting off of missiles between the U.S. and South Korea, was to do another test of the THAAD system, and it is also to, by President Moon, as we said, to agree to the full deployment of THAAD. And now I think pushing South Korea to get more of its own missiles. So this is just escalating and escalating. And when our delegation went, and our primary goal there was to show solidarity with the people who are opposing THAAD, in the U.S., anybody who even knows what it is, and I'm sure the vast majority have no idea, they think the THAAD system is a, quote, anti-missile defense system. But when you look into it more, it really is a system that is designed to escalate, ratchet up the arms race, because North Korea has its missiles. We put in an anti-missile system. Then North Korea has to find new missiles that can outsmart the anti-missile system. Then we have to do the same. And who benefits in all of this? Lockheed Martin. So, yes, it's just a ratcheting up of the arms race.
Mm-hmm. Well, a dangerous spiral for sure. But thank you so much for joining the show, Medea, and at least raising the issue of trying to change these things, traveling between Korea here in the United States. We are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. Well, we were hoping to bring you here in this third segment a little bit of follow-up on the major controversy from several months ago regarding missing girls in D.C. We are going to have to push that conversation until our show tomorrow due to some late-breaking news here. Before we came on air, Mr. Anthony Scaramucci, who is the White House Communications Director, former Wall Street investor, fundraiser for Donald Trump, involved in the transition, formerly of the Export-Import Bank as well, has been fired. I guess as these things go, he resigned, but you know how that is. They just tell you you can resign right before they fire you, but apparently at the behest of John Kelly, the new chief of staff, wanted him gone. Now he's gone. The mooch is gone. So we're going to continue this conversation with Brandon Sutton, who is the host of the Discourse podcast with Progressive Army, and Bob Schlehuber, who is a news analyst here at Radio Sputnik. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I hear you. It's definitely a laughing moment. This is the third straight office, by the way, Brandon, that the Trump administration has set the record for the shortest possible tenure in. Your thoughts on Mooch being pushed out of here?
Well, I mean, first of all, two quick thoughts. Who would have thought that the person who got, you know, famous in the political and mainstream landscape for firing people would continue that trend once he became, you know, for the United States of America? And two, this is hilarious, right? And I know some people are going to think that's mean-spirited, but, like, this dude, Scaramucci, gave up essentially everything for this job. He gave up his business, he missed the birth of his first or second child, and his wife left him. And, you know, it was all to be the comms director of the White House, some sort of power play, and, you know, up in smoke.
And I was trying to see if I couldn't laugh, but I have no choice. Yeah, I mean, really unbelievable. Bob Schlehuber, your thoughts on seeing Mr. Scaramucci asked to leave?
Yeah, I don't know how many times we have to consistently be tricked by Trump to think, yeah, oh, he'll finally do something different. He's got a new comms guy, director guy, new White House, whatever. And then obviously, of course, the guy's going to get fired in 10 days. Why is everybody not predicting this every time? And so it's been interesting, though. I think the other kind of subtle story here is that we've seen that John Kelly's going to have some control as his chief of staff, and that should be scary for a lot of people to have a general in a civilian-led government all of a sudden this close to the presidency. And obviously, clearly, Donald Trump is listening to him if he said, hey, I'm going to do this job, but the first thing we have to do is get rid of Scaramucci. Whoever came in to be chief of staff should have got rid of Scaramucci either way. But is this kind of a tipping point now that this general will be heard more, and he's coming over from Homeland Security, which also has its own problems and is very problematic what we're doing in way of spying and tracking American citizens. So I think kind of the undercurrent to the joking, laughing matter of Scaramucci being out is Kelly now being in with power.
Well, Brandon Sutton, I'm curious what you think about that. There have been a lot of concerns in the media raised about that today. Three of the four top appointed positions now held by generals, some people saying that makes a mockery out of the idea of civilian government. Your thoughts?
I mean, I think that's been an underlying story with a lot of decisions made by the Trump administration in the past, I would say, few months. Right. Oh, it's only been a few months, actually. Wow. But, you know, like the slow ceding of the executive power to the, you know, the military industrial complex or various generals. Right. So we know that a few months ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, he allowed the Pentagon to control troop numbers in Afghanistan. And that story kind of got buried, too, under the weight of the more spectacular Trump actions. But, you know, when we talk about you know, democracy being eroded, right? The actions of Trump that actually erode democracy and actually make a mockery of the separations of power and actually do all these things. It's really like, you know, the underlying story is the military and its various leaders are getting more and more power. And for certain people in Washington and also certain people in the media, that's a good thing, right? We've seen the media champion the military industrial complex. And whenever Trump does something that is more in line with the wants of the military or the Pentagon, he is lauded. So I could, you know, we can't absolve the media in terms of in these decisions he's making to give more power to general, because that's sort of been what the way they've been leading him.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, the whole sort of adults in the room aspect of how they cover it, Bob.
No, I mean, and we've talked about on this show and other places that people need, in my opinion, to stop looking at Trump as this brand new thing. America's never been in this situation. We've never been faced with these crises. It's never been this bad. The U.S. military has been always around. The military-industrial complex has always been around. They've always been controlling.
Well, they haven't always been around. No, the military-industrial complex and the large standing army since after World War II. Right. It's a relevant point.
Right. And so at least having a little longer historical perspective outside of these last 7 months with Donald Trump there, but saying in the last 60 years that this thing has completely risen up to control major aspects of our government, and when we don't have that analysis and we just look at Trump as the problem, I think we're completely missing what's actually happening in Washington, D.C. around controls of weapons, controls of major, major portions of the U.S. budget is being run by the military. We want to get Medicaid for all. We want to have education for people. We want to end homelessness in this country. We want to have food and nutrition for everyone that wants it. But yet we continue to spend it on military bombing, troop surges in different countries around the world. That's not Donald Trump. I mean, that's something that's been around, again, like you said, in more recent history. And I think the lack of perspective on that and as Brandon's saying that these stories get buried. I mean, Eric Prince was advising the White House the other day on what to do in Afghanistan, that he was advising George W. Bush. So to think of Trump as a singular crazy one guy off the path, I think he's on path along with a lot of these generals, and they're closer and closer to the wheels of power, the levers of power now.
It is an interesting concept there. Despite my correction, I think Bob is making a good point. I mean, you know, it's funny, Brandon, people always say, well, we've never had a president that was like this bigoted or something. And I'm like, wait a second, we had like 8 slave owner presidents. Like, what are we even talking about right now? Like the history of America, I don't know, it's like almost like this fake history. Like America was really good, then it was like briefly bad here and there, and then it was good again, and then Trump came, and now it's really bad, worse than it's ever been. And it's sort of like, well, yeah, it's really bad for sure, but on the same level, you might say it's par for the course for America.
I mean, I don't know if it's fake history. It's definitely sort of like the history, or rather American history as interpreted by sort of reactionary centrists, right? Mm. Like it's American history as interpreted by the people who, for whom Trump is this big divergence from the norm, because they were only really focused on the representational aspects of the presidency. And the president as the celebrity, politics as this abstract thing that has no material consequences. I would say that reached its height or pinnacle prior to Trump, like under Obama, right? Mm. Obama was the celebrity president who is probably going to be solely remembered for, you know, and also due to Trump, really, for his, you know, grace and poise and, you know, having people be proud of him as this figurehead for America, as opposed to any sort of material changes that were made under him. But I definitely agree with, you know, what's being said here about, you know, this focus on Trump as this singular irrational actor who, you know, at the push of a button can bomb Syria, at the push of a button can bomb North Korea, does have the effect of erasing, you know, large portions of American history, large portions of, you know, the deep state, these advisors, these people who exist, you know, outside of elected government officials. And frankly, it's to the benefit of both parties to pretend as though Trump exists on this island politically, right? That there is no historical or contemporaneous precedent for him, and that, you know, if we can just get rid of Trump, you can have Pence and everything can go back to normalcy, because Trump represents this sort of vague notion of a chaotic actor.
Now, I think that's a good point. Well, Bob, let me see if I can allay your fears about some of this here, because as crazy as everything is in the White House, as much is going on, there's one meeting that has not been getting a lot of coverage that's happening once a week amongst cabinet members, and that's a Bible study regularly attended by Tom Price, Rick Perry, Betsy DeVos, Sonny Perdue, Jeff Sessions, and Mike Pompeo. Bob, do you feel better now knowing that the moral core, the moral fiber of the cabinet is being renewed once a week?
I mean, you know who wished they would have gone to those prayer meetings a couple years ago was Hillary Clinton. I mean, she lost the evangelical Christian vote. It was like 85% to 15%. I mean, she absolutely got
When she was in the Senate, she was a part of those weekly prayer.
She decided to stop praying on the campaign trail, apparently, and going to those meetings. If there is a God, I'll take any and all prayers from every religion out there. So whatever you believe in, I'm happy for you to pray for me. That would be wonderful. The prayer meetings do not bring me much peace of mind, especially with the names you mentioned and the type of Christianity a lot of those people subscribe to. I think those type of people were probably all for the trans military ban that was announced last week. Hopefully there's not actually any follow-up to it. I don't think Trump would actually know how to actually implement a plan like that beyond tweeting it. And I don't think that necessarily changes the day-to-day operations of the entire U.S. military is through a tweet. Hopefully not. But no, I'm not feeling too great about it. I don't know why you thought that was going to make me feel better, but I appreciate the effort. Maybe that's helping Brandon out. But
Help somebody. According to the minister who teaches it, he just praises God for them, Brandon. He praises God for them and praises God that Donald Trump chose great people to lead our nation. Do you feel safe and secure knowing there's a weekly Bible study in the West Wing?
I mean, hasn't that always been the case, though? Like, remember back when Bush started the Iraq War, you know, it was essentially we had generals coming out there and basically calling it a crusade, right? You know, like Bush told him that God told America that God told him to invade Iraq. And so, like, again, even, you know, this Bible study is like nothing new. It's like it's nothing out of the ordinary. Maybe it's out of the ordinary that it's being sort of attended by these, you know, let's be honest, malevolent actors. But you know, this is like the idea that, you know, church and state are separate, right, it's true on paper. But I'd like to see a candidate run for office who is, you know, theoretically an atheist, not directly atheist, vocally an atheist, who's like, you know, my faith plays no part in the way I plan on running this country. Like literally, I will not, you know, and I would like to see them, you know, actually – like that'd be a winning strategy, but that's not the case. You can't come out as an atheist or someone whose faith doesn't play a big role in the way to make decisions in America and still expect to, you know, have a good showing in presidential election.
It's dangerous too. A lot of times, I think if you're not having a reflective or responsive theology, that you can trick yourself into always believing that God put you in the position for a purpose. That anytime you have mistaken or been wrong, you just pray for your forgiveness and God will correct your way, and you're not interacting with diverse people that have diverse beliefs and faiths. And I think that's kind of the foundation of the United States, is that it's, well, at least marketed as this great melting pot where all ideas are equally held. But all of a sudden, if you are the chosen people by God, or you think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict where you have peoples that are chosen by God for a certain land and stuff, you can get down a mindset and block off and not hear a lot of other perspectives. So as much as we're kind of making light of this prayer meeting, it's also extremely terrifying that you block out a larger marketplace of shared ideas and beliefs that can lead to different types of policies, and we're kind of locked into one set here.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case. And what people are doing, Jimmy Carter used to have a little prayer circle right there.
Who was Bush's guy, that Tim, the guy that got in trouble for his relations with younger boys?
Ted Haggard. No, Ted Haggard. Wait, was it? All right, Brandon, you got to help us now. Ted Haggard was the one who smoked crystal meth, and who was the?
No, he was Tim Haggard was the
who
guy.
Who was the airport one?
I was 9 in 2000.
Okay. Ted Haggard. I just thought that you would know who.
I thought you would be up on which spiritual advisors were smoking crystal meth. I just thought that you'd be up on that.
I'll pray tonight to forgive our sins if we are wrong with any of the names we threw out there. And if anybody took offense, please know that God forgives us.
All I know is that John Boehner got successfully primaried by a snake handler. That's, I guess that's as far as I know about.
Oh, there's a lot of great stories out there.
That's not a sex joke.
That's
he handles real snakes.
You know, there's was John Ashcroft who lost to the dead guy the time that he ran for Senate, which just has to be that. I mean, if you need a vote of no confidence, you need a vote of no confidence. But I mean, nevertheless, it does speak, Brandon, to some degree, like about the, in my view, one of the problems of the Trump administration is that, like, in some ways, it's so shambolic and so pirate show like. It's like very amusing. I mean, it almost is like a little sitcom, but then actually the things they are doing are so terrible on a day in, day out basis. I mean, it's almost like it's a strategy.
I avoid putting any sort of like meaning or intentionality behind Trump's actions in this way, because I think that, you know, that's sort of a way of assuaging ourselves of the idea that the person who is the head of America is essentially a moron. I think that if, you know, If you believe that Trump is a moron, an impulsive, childish, petty moron who happens to operate at the exact social frequency of America, you know, American popular culture, American political culture, American media culture, it explains everything well enough. But the idea he's some sort of fifth dimensional chess player, like, you know, hashing it out with Mr. Mixel Pitlick in the White House is ridiculous. But I do think that it can be distracting. But at the same time, you know, the trans ban over Twitter is a good example of this. Like we can't take the position, the vaguely privileged position of saying, well, you know, when Trump stokes hatred or does these weird things or craven things online, that, you know, like they're distractions that we shouldn't be distracted, because they do have actual effects on the lives of people who are, you know, who tend to be marginalized, regardless of whether they have actual policy implications in the end.
Mm-hmm. No, good point. Bob Slayhuber.
No, this stuff's incredibly dangerous in a very serious note when you run around and making comments. I think two other stories we're going to run out of time here is talking about Trump's tough on police speech. Hey, if you want to be brutal as a police officer, hey, the guy's a criminal when you lock him up. And you see real life consequences that people hear this stuff and they don't check themselves, right? So maybe it's like, oh, we're just kind of being distracted in Trump's chaos and he's just throwing that stuff out there. Well, the person that's out there reading the stuff, that's thinking about doing this stuff, isn't going to be stopped or swayed elsewhere not to do this stuff. And it's incredibly dangerous. And as much light we make of some of these stories, there's real life ramifications for people that live in unprotected.
Yeah, Brandon, go ahead.
Oh, definitely. And I think that, you know, so like there's two parts to that Trump speech story to like whatever police he was speaking to, is that A, they cheered. It's like none of those police officers booed or said, you know, this is not okay. They cheered because ultimately we can never forget that, you know, these people endorsed them. It's like it's not as though the Fraternal Order of Police don't like Trump. They released a statement, you know, a few hours ago, I want to say, that basically supported or gave, you know, a little out for Trump, saying that he gets a little bit ahead of himself and the media is always misinterpreting his words. It's, you know, they already believe that these structures already existed. And, you know, in this incarnation, same with ICE, same with the Border Patrol.
And as we move on, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there today. That was Brandon Sutton. You were just hearing there the Discourse podcast. Check it out. That is his podcast and also everything Progressive Army is doing. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.